This conference will now be recorded.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for logging on, joining the meeting. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Thank you all for being here. First item of business is a roll call. And just a reminder that these meetings are being recorded. So if you can remember, when you do speak up for a comment or question, please identify yourself beforehand. So beginning with the roll call for the minutes, I'm Peter Lisi, Chair of the Board. When I call your name, please signify by saying aye or you, that you're on the call, and we will record it for the minutes. So Chief of Board, Mike Angelini.
Present.
Lawrence Davis.
Present.
Gerald Hill.
Present.
Kim Kennison. Kim? All right. Kim is not on. Barbara Lindsay. Barbara. Okay. Stella Lopez.
Here.
Susan Martin.
I'm here.
Alan Matamana.
I'm here.
Thank you. Mark Vaholak.
I'm here.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, Chief of Staff, Jeanette Weldon. I see Jeanette, she might be muted.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Denise Aguilera. Denise, are you on?
Here.
Thank you. Deb Galley.
Here.
Dan Junji.
Dan Junji is present.
Thank you. Bob Jandro.
Bob Jandro was present.
Thank you. Krista Johnson. Krista? No Krista. Dan Kurowski. Thank you. Eileen McDonald.
Present.
Thank you. Joanne Makowitz.
Present.
Thank you. Michael Morris.
Present.
Thank you. Cynthia Peoples.
I'm here.
Kara Stewart.
Hello.
Is that a yes? For?
Sorry, I'm here.
Thank you. Betty Sugarman Weintraub.
Present.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else from CHIFA whose name I did not call?
Barbara Lindsay from the board.
Okay, Barbara, glad to have you on.
Josh Sherlock from CHESL.
Thank you, Josh. Anyone else? Okay. Other advisors, consultants, when I call the firm's name, I don't want to make the assumption that a particular person is on. So I'm going to call out the name of a firm, and if you're on representing the firm, please just give us your name. Starting with Shipman and Goodwin.
Yes, Bruce Chadwick's on. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Hardwick Law Firm. Anyone from Hardwick? Hinckley Allen.
Hardwick is here. I'm sorry.
Would that be Mary Jo Kelly?
My phone wasn't working correctly. Yes, it's Mary Jo Kelly.
Thank you. Hinckley Allen.
Thank you.
Tom Marion from Hinckley Allen's on. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Tom. Pullman and Comley.
Good afternoon. Eric Russell is on.
Thank you, Eric. Robinson and Cole.
Hi, Ed Samarachik is on.
Thank you. Acacia Financial.
Shelby Lobitz is on.
Thank you. Dave Pitney.
Judith Blank is on.
Thank you, Judith. Anyone from PFM, Public Financial Management?
Trina Smith is here.
Thank you, Trina. McCarter in English? Anyone from McCarter in English? Okay.
Hi, it's Jane Warren.
Jane?
Hi, it's Jane Warren.
Representing McCarter in English?
Yes.
Thank you.
Jane Warren.
Thank you. Carmody Torrance?
Hi, it's Jan Zucker.
Okay. Did I miss anyone on the consultant or for consultants or attorneys?
Good afternoon. This is Christy Flynn from Hawkins, Delafield & Wood.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Mac Welch from Ziegler is on as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any others? Okay. Welcome, one and all. Thank you for the roll call. If we could get the agenda back up on the screen, that'd be helpful. But the first order of business is approving the minutes from our October 21st meeting. I hope folks have taken a minute to look at them. Is there a motion to accept the minutes from October 21st?
This is Mike Angelini. So moved.
Right. I'll second Estela.
Thank you. We've got a motion and a second to accept the minutes from October 21st. Are there any corrections or edits? Corrections or edits to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes as proposed, please signify by saying aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Any abstentions? Okay, thank you. Motion passes. Next item of business is our annual ethics training. I will turn it over to Nancy Nicolescu to give us our annual review. Nancy, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nancy Nicolescu, and I'm the Director of Education and Communications for the Office of State Ethics. It's that time of year again, and so I welcome the board for inviting me today. It gives me great pleasure to provide you with this presentation that I hope and no doubt believe that it'll guide you in your role as distinguished public officials and members of the Connecticut of CHIFA. And congratulations to any new members or appointments on the board. So I'm going to get started here. And certainly, you know, when we're thinking about ethics, I always like to talk about what is ethics, and they're personal. They're different for each and every one of us. I love this quote by Roy Disney. He was Walt Disney's brother. And it's not hard to make decisions when you know what your values are. And again, very different for each and every one of us based on our religion, our culture, and what we do for work. The Code of Ethics is about a specific set of rules and laws about what is allowable as public officials and state employees. They're value oriented. Many of you have heard me share this quote with you. It's one of my favorites by Potter Stewart, knowing the difference between what you have a right to do and what it's right to do. And I believe that as public officials or state employees, we get up every day, go to work, and want to do the best possible job that we can. It's important for us to know what the limits are and how they apply to us in our daily work. They're practical. Ethics are what you do when nobody's looking. And Mark Twain said, it's never wrong to do the right thing. A little bit about our agency. We're a watchdog agency, civil enforcement agency, independently established to oversee state government. We were created in 77 after Watergate, recreated in 2005 after the state of Connecticut was embroiled in scandals. And we do have a 9-member board, very similar to yours, that oversees our agency. The most important thing that you need to know about our agency is that we're not a gotcha agency. We really do want to help you get it right. And so because your agency is so phenomenal at having me come on toward this time of year every year and to present, I thought, let me do something a little bit different. I shared this presentation a couple weeks ago at one of your other meetings. And so I thought I would continue on and just for the folks that were here that week. But I wanted to take a look back at in history. I mean, why do we do, you know, why does the Code of Ethics exist? You know, what really took us down this road, this maze of corruption. And so I wanted to explore that and to kind of give you the history on how we got the nickname Corrupticut. And it really happened in the early 2000s, but I wanted to go back a little bit farther than that, just kind of share some of this with you. So in the 1930s, Frank Hayes, he was a mayor. He was also lieutenant governor, and he changed the city charter when he was elected, giving him all of the power. And we always have to ask ourselves, you know, is corruption ingrained in politics and in power and in those types of things? And with Frank Hayes, he was convicted along with 26 others for defrauding the city out of more than $1 million. It was the city of Waterbury. He steered money to contractors. He had a banker who laundered money for him, and was really known as they called him a villain, and he was very much an investor. And kind of what brought him to light when he was very interested in investing in electric steam sterilizers for bathrooms, and there was only one company that was making this item. And so that was something that he had brought before the General Assembly. And so then eyebrows started to raise and investigations began. But interestingly, Sherwood Rowland won his election as comptroller of the city by 30 votes. And that's who uncovered what was happening at that time. And so that was the 1930s. In the 1960s, we had Thomas J. Dodd, who was the first U.S. senator to come before the Senate Ethics Committee for formal censure. And he served two terms. He used his personal campaign funds. And he says, well, you know, the people that I raised money from knew that I was going to be spending their donations for personal expenses. And so this was definitely during a time when things were very new in terms of especially this type of censure. And kind of the backstory to Thomas Dodd was that he had a huge family. He had, I believe he had like 12 children. You know that his son is Dodd, Christopher Dodd, held office. I believe he's still in office. I'm not quite sure about that. I think so. But ironically, Thomas Dodd wasn't living a life of luxury. He really was using those personal payments to make those mortgage payments and to keep food on the table for his very large family. But it didn't matter. And he ended up losing. He ran for re-election as an independent, and he lost. But it really was what many believe, you know, destroyed him as a man and ultimately that he died right after losing that re-election. So we jump into the 1990s, which really kind of brings together. There really was enough scandal to go around in Connecticut in the early 90s. And many of you may remember or may not remember Paul Sylvester, but he was our state treasurer. And he was racketeering and, you know,
thank you,
prior to launch money, and taking bribes. He was the nation's youngest state treasurer. He was up and coming, and he faced 40 years in prison, but sought a reduced sentence in giving out information about what was going on with other government officials. Ultimately, he spent 4 years and 3 months in prison, but he was the sole fiduciary over our pension funds. I believe it was around $18 billion. So this was explosive. And right around that same time, you had US state's attorneys that were also taking part at different things. There was a mayor in Danbury, Mayor Dyer, who ultimately was also racketeering and doing these types of things. And he had hired Hugh Keefe, and that's where Hugh Keefe actually, many of you know the name, high-powered defense lawyer, and he cut his teeth on that dire case. McGinnon was the original U.S. attorney, and it seemed that he was taking too hard of a hand on corruption and scandal that was going on in Connecticut. So they asked him to step down, and that's when Stanley Twardy took over. But he certainly didn't relent, and the investigations went on. Even during this time, Mayor Santa Petro, he actually bankrupted a bank. And so the list goes on and on. You can understand what was happening. And so now we get to, you know, in 2005, you have John G. Rowland, but his history is he was a rising star. You know, he was very young, started his career as a legislator at age 23. At age 27, he was a member of Congress. In 2002, he was at the peak of his political career. He wins his third term for governor. And so he's going on. But right along with the Sylvester investigation, there's a federal probe. And so in 2004, because of that federal probe, he resigns. And later on that year, he pleads guilty to one felony count of conspiracy to commit theft of honest services and tax fraud. And so on March 18th, the day after St. Patrick's Day, he was convicted and he received a sentence of, actually he was sentenced that day. He received a sentence of 1 year plus 1 day in prison and 4 months of home confinement. And so that's kind of, you know, I like to talk about ethics. I talked at the beginning that they're personal and they're all of these things. And so you have this individual who's the governor of our state, you know, convicted and sentenced. And 10 years later to the day, he was sentenced for 7 crimes, 5 of them felonies associated with conspiracy to break federal campaign law. So you can't teach ethics. You can't give someone ethics. And so he falls twice. And because of those events throughout the early 90s into the 2000s, when Governor Rell took over, she issued Executive Order Number 1. And these were the sweeping reforms that happened right after the scandals. So she actually required ethics audits and agency ethics statements, which CHIFA has an ethics statement, wanted all individuals that were seeking employment with the state to be noticed, that they would have to comply with the code of ethics if they were hired, that they would acknowledge it, receipt, and agree to comply, and that every agency had assigned an ethics liaison or a compliance officer. CHIFA's ethics liaison is Denise. And, you know, I practiced saying your last name right before I came on, Aguilera. I think I got it. And then there were some other reforms that went into play with that, like statements of financial interests. And many of the board members are filers and they file SFIs. They added non-restricted donor gift limits. There were state treasurer limitations that were added and finder fees and revolving door and legal defense funds. So it was quite comprehensive what they put into play. And certainly we believe that it has made a difference in Connecticut. So back to our laws and what's really important for you. And I hope you enjoyed the little bit of history, but it is important to know the limits. We do have a little top 10 rules handout that I know your agency, I've shared with your agency for distribution, but the code of ethics covers gifts, conflicts of interest, use of state position and other employment, as well as revolving door. But our most important rule is to always get advice. You can go through Denise for advice. You can call our agency. We have our guide, plain language guides on our website. All that information is readily available. In terms of our gift provisions, there are a lot of exceptions, but pretty much generally, I just like to say, don't accept gifts. A gift is anything of value directly and personally received unless consideration is given. The whole point of the code is about using your position for financial benefit. If you use your position to put money in your pocket, your family's pocket, or an associated business's pocket, you have a conflict of interest. And so you certainly, as board members, have to be very careful and very aware that you are a public official, that you do deal with lobbyists and contractors. There are many businesses that are seeking to do business with CHIFA or are doing business with CHIFA. That's a definition of a contractor. And or a lot of those businesses are also registered as lobbyists in the state of Connecticut. So the very strict provisions and prohibitions apply there. So if you have a conflict, the law requires you to abstain or recuse yourself. And when you leave your state position as a board member or as a state employee, there are revolving door provisions. There are lifetime bans where you can never disclose confidential information. You cannot side switch. You cannot be, there are 1-year bans where you cannot come before your former agency for 1 year. You must cool off. And you also cannot accept employment with someone with which you entered into a contract. So for employees of CHIFA, it's 1 year from the date they leave state service. So if you entered into a contract over $50,000 with a contractor that's doing business with your agency, you cannot be employed by them for 1 year from the date you leave your employment at CHIFA. For the board members, it's 1 year from the date that the contract was signed. So those are some little revolving door provisions to be aware of. Enforcement is another part of our agency. I mean, we spend a lot of time providing education and advice, but we also have an enforcement division, which is firewalled from our legal division. We do accept complaints, and they are confidential. And they remain confidential until probable cause determination has been made by a hearing by a judge trial referee. If our board does find that there's a violation of the code, they can ask you to comply with it in the future. They can have you file any required reports or statements, and they can issue civil penalties of up to $10,000 per violation. If the case, if the violation is criminal, bribery, things of that nature, most likely it would be referred to the Chief State's Attorney's Office for their action. And so you have to ask yourself, you have to make those decisions today about what are your rules, what will you do, what won't you do. You're, of course, remembered for the rules that you break, so be careful about that. Or you could, you know, we would have a slide handily made. And I know this was very brief and I didn't get deeply into the law, but I encourage you, if I talked about anything like conflicts of interest and you want more detail, please reach out to Denise, reach out to me directly, or, you know, email our agency, and our legal division attorneys will respond to you and give you that legal advice, whether it's over the phone, in email, in writing. Please always refer back to rule number one and get advice. So with that, I end. If you have any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Any questions?
It's Daryl Hill. I have just one. Well, observation first. Sounds like somebody's typing, giving us some background noise. My question is about the lifetime ban. As you went through that, it seemed like it only applies to the disclosing of confidential information or proprietary information. Is that the only lifetime ban?
No, the second lifetime ban is, thank you for the question. The second lifetime ban is on side switching. So if we're substantially involved in a contract, and if you're substantially involved in a contract, you and you leave your position at CHIFA, you cannot switch sides. You cannot renegotiate that contract at any other time. You can create a new contract, but you cannot tear down privately what you built up publicly. That was the quick version of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Daryl. Any other questions for Nancy? All right, Nancy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will see you in a year.
Ah, okay, perfect.
Thank you. Okay, continuing on, Jeanette, Executive Director's Report.
Yeah, here. And I wanted to start by referencing an opinion piece that appeared in the Connecticut Mirror on Monday. And I'm not sure if any of you have seen it, but if you haven't, we can certainly circulate it to the board after the meeting. But it's an opinion piece written by an Eastern Connecticut State University professor. It has a lot of erroneous information and assumptions in it, but the bottom line is there's an interpretation that through CHIFA, the state has lent to private colleges and schools, you know, billions and billions of dollars, like close to $8 billion state lending is the way it's being described to these entities. And then it goes through a couple of different examples with a couple of focus on some particular transactions, but it really seems to be sort of a misunderstanding of how CHIFA functions, whose money is being invested, and also fails to mention the fact that a prime beneficiary of CHIFA financing is Connecticut State Colleges and Universities, including Eastern in particular, that has financed a number of campus improvements through CHIFA. So at first we were thinking we potentially, you know, would not respond. It's an opinion piece, it's not an article, but subsequently we have gotten a couple of inquiries through the Office of Fiscal Analysis, where different legislators have posed questions to aides there, saying, "Can you get in touch with CHIFA and get me some information?" And then also, at least one of our clients expressed, who is a school, expressed some concern with the article. So the plan right now is to provide a response. And as well as responding, obviously, to the Office of Fiscal Analysis. And one of the things we will point to certainly is our economic impact study, which will also emphasize the impact of CHIFA financings on the state's economy. So just wanted to make people aware of that. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention briefly, we were approached by the Nonprofit Finance Fund, which is actually a CDFI, a national CDFI with a focus on nonprofits. And this is a connection that developed out of some work we did. If you recall, we had an engagement with the Urban Institute, and this is a connection that developed out of that. They got in touch because they are continuing to work on some of those initiatives, and they're now exploring the concept of creating a health equity trust in Connecticut. And so it's a concept that we're still learning some of the features of, but it would involve, it's not solely a philanthropic initiative. There's the potential for other, you know, financing to also be part of this health equity trust mechanism, and the focus being, you know, activities and undertakings that are going to help move forward with health equity in the state. So very much exploratory phases. Betty and I have had a conversation with them. They're doing some, putting together some working groups to further explore this. So we're planning to participate may or may not lead anywhere, but at this point, our plan is to certainly explore it. So just wanted to make mention of that. So are there any questions on either of those items?
Yeah, Janet, I usually read the opinion pieces of the Connecticut Mirror. I didn't see, for some whatever reason, Monday, I didn't see the one that you mentioned. Could you send us a copy? Could you send me a copy? Thank you.
Yes, we'll send it to the entire board just to make sure everyone has seen it.
And I appreciate that, Estelle. And I guess I would just like to take it one step further. When Jeanette and her senior staff, whomever, compose the reply, Jeanette, it might be a good idea just to send a copy of what you write back to distribute that to the board members as well. Just in the event a board member ever gets a question or something from a colleague in the field and they say, hey, I saw that opinion piece in the Connecticut Mirror, it'd just be nice to have the board members have all the information, the article, the opinion piece itself, as well as your reply.
Yes, that's an excellent point, and we'll do that.
Great. Any other questions for Jeanette? Okay, thank you. Michael, client update? Michael, I think you're on mute.
How's that?
That's better.
Thank you. Our piece of the pie, just to refresh your memory and to give some background to the new members of the board. This was a transaction that closed in 2014. Has about $4.6 million of outstanding. They opened up a charter school in Wyndham called Path Academy. This was an alternative high school degree program. They lost their charter in 2018 for a variety of reasons. It has been in default since 2018 and in payment default since 2019. The property will be sold on online auction by an online auction firm December 7th to 9th. The proceeds will be applied to the amount outstanding and the remainder will be forgiven. This is a private placement. Yale University, we're working on two remarketings totaling $275 million that have mandatory dates in the beginning of February. And we're also just recently got inquiries from two schools that will be refunding their bond issues when they come due in July of next year. But they want to get going on those. And also we're going to look at refunding the one of the child care issues, the 2011 issue that has $16 million outstanding. That's also callable in July 2021. There's pretty good savings there, $2.1 million or 13% of the refunded bond. So we're going to start working on that. And that's it.
Any other questions for Mike? All right, thank you. Joanne, you have a financial report?
Sorry, good afternoon, everybody. For the 3 months ended in September 30th, 2020, our revenues exceed expenses by $1.1 million before non-operating expenses, which were $1 million. Resulting in a change in net position of about $78,000. Our revenues are under budget by $40,000, and our expenses are also under budget by $64,000. That is all I have for now.
Okay. All right. Appreciate the summary. Are there questions for Joanne?
All right. Thank you.
Hearing none, we'll move on to Cynthia and interest rates. Thank you, Joanne.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to, with the report that's here, you can see obviously the rates are low with not much move in the federal on the Fed fund rate. I wanted to point to some comments by the federal, the Fed chair Powell regarding the vaccine, saying that the news is encouraging in the medium term outlook in the economy, but can't address the surge in the virus has on the immediate term. and the downside risks to the near-term outlook remain significant. So there is no change in the foreseeable future, and potentially some stimulus in the new year related to the virus response.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Any questions? All right, moving along, Bob, you're going to do the market update?
Yep, nothing really to highlight on the transaction report itself, as there were no issues local to our market. The market continues to exhibit good levels of activity, despite some recent weeks of light supply. However, the market is anticipating one final push of supply prior to the Thanksgiving holiday, which should be easily digested given the strong technicals that are currently in place. We've mentioned pretty much all year long the increase in taxable issuance, particularly for taxable advance refundings. Thus far, approximately $95 billion, or 57% of taxable issuance, has been for taxable advance refundings. J.P. Morgan is estimating that approximately $110 billion of tax-exempt candidates that could be on the radar for 2021 for taxable advance refundings.
Okay. Any questions for Bob? All right. Thank you, Bob. Josh, Chesla update?
Yes, thank you, Peter. So I'll start on slide two with Chesla's in-school program. So in quarter one, Chesla's in-school program dispersed $6.9 million, which represents a 32% decrease from quarter one in fiscal 20. Obviously, due to the pandemic, Chesla had downsized its bond yield this year by 28%, anticipating a decrease in loan volume. I would say on a positive note, October disbursements did total $1.4 million, which you can see equates the entirety of quarter two for fiscal 20. I would also say from a comparison to cash flow standpoint, the disbursements have been a little bit behind the cash flows through September. However, the strong October brings the disbursements almost right in line with the cash flow assumptions. Moving on to page three, we have Chesla's refinance loan program. In quarter one here, disbursements totaled about 270,000, which is about $500,000 behind quarter one of fiscal 20. This decrease is again attributable to COVID and the pandemic. On the federal student loan side, payments continue to be suspended through December here, with also 0% interest rates. So I think that's largely a driving factor to the slow disbursements on the refi program. I would say we did have a solid October. October refi disbursements totaled $156,000. In terms of disbursements compared to the cash flow assumptions, Chesla's 2019A series is about $600,000 behind the cash flow assumptions. However, revenue has maintained a steady pace, and we're in good shape from a debt service perspective. There's no concern about paying the debt service on our bonds. Moving on to slide four, just an update on the scholarship program. So the scholarship for undergraduate degrees, we had 166 selected recipients totaling $484,500, representing 23 institutions in 64 Connecticut cities and towns. Those disbursements were sent out on September 3rd. regarding our scholarships for a healthcare or manufacturing certificate program. The application opened on July 1st with $50,000 available. That is available on a first come, first serve basis. Anyone that meets the EFC expected family contribution of $6,000 or less and provides a letter of recommendation will receive the scholarship. Thus far, the disbursements have been slow, with only two certificate scholarships going out the door, totaling $2,500. We continue to market the program through the WIBS and with targeted emails to the heads of the certificate programs through the schools throughout the state. Moving on.
Josh, yeah. Before we leave that, Peter, yeah. For the healthcare manufacturing certificate program, have the disbursements been slow because the number of applicants is, there are not many applicants, or you're getting plenty of applicants, but they're not qualified applicants? What's going on with the slow disbursements on that?
So there's been, I think, close to 200 applications started, but a majority of those were not completed. Our suspicion is that there were applications started for those pursuing an undergraduate degree, not understanding that these are targeted to certificate programs. The reason the disbursements are slow are quite simply because there have not been many applications submitted. Once an application is submitted, we can get the disbursements out, you know, within a week to the school.
Right, but you just haven't had many applicants, basically.
Correct.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
No problem. Moving to slide 5, CHESL's outreach program regarding our financial aid presentation has moved to a virtual format. Thus far, we have presented to Sanford High School, Lewis Mills in Burlington, Granville Academy in Waterbury, Manchester Heights School, and then the Sport and Medical Sciences Academy. And then lastly, on slide 6, just a brief marketing highlights. And I just wanted to mention that CHESL had a spot run pregame and during game 4 of the World Series between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And CHESL also had a spot run during round 4 of the Masters Golf Tournament. So we're continuing to market, and we thought those were two particular marketing spots to note. And that's it. Any further questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Okay, a couple of financings to discuss. First one being Doncaster.
The next agenda item is the legislative agenda.
I'm sorry, Jeanette. That's getting okay. Ahead of ourselves. You're on.
I just wanted to provide the context for the legislative agenda, which was in everyone's board package. And then we're just going to highlight a few of the major initiatives. So in putting together the legislative agenda, we really, consider lots of things. We start with what is in Chief's strategic plan and what are our strategic priorities. We're also looking at, what are the state's priorities and what initiatives is the state focused on. And then obviously we're also looking at, society, as a whole, societal factors. And certainly in the current climate, including things like racial inequality. So with that's the context in which we developed this legislative agenda. It does have components that are CHEFA related, CHESA related, and CHEFA CDC related. And there are some smaller sort of tweaking features, which are really identical to what we submitted in last year's agenda, but we wanted to highlight the high profile items. So With that, I would like to ask Michael to comment on the extraterritorial legislation that is the chief of proposal.
Sure. Once again, we're seeking to submit legislation to allow CHIFA to issue bonds on behalf of hospitals and healthcare systems for out-of-state projects. Just a little legislative background. Back in 2019, we made some headway, made it out of the Senate, was assigned a calendar number in the House, but it was towards the end of the session and there was no action taken prior to the adjournment. Earlier this year, we received a hearing, but didn't make it out of committee because the Office of Fiscal Analysis flagged it over concerns that the language as drafted would have inadvertently allowed the use of scarce-backed bonds to fund out-of-state projects. There's three provisions of the bill. One is for hospitals and healthcare systems that are headquartered in the state. If they're affiliating with another hospital that's in any other state, we would be able to do that project. And the second applies to contiguous states in New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, where there's a hospital health system that is headquartered outside Connecticut, but is affiliated with a hospital in-state, we would be able to do that project. An example would be the Western Connecticut Health Network. When they merged with HealthQuest, the HealthQuest system was headquartered in New York, but affiliated with Western Connecticut. We would have been able to issue the bonds for the refunding of all the HealthQuest bonds, plus the new projects there, as well as new projects in Connecticut. Instead, we had to go to another authority in New York, the Dutchess County Development Corporation. So there's two authorities involved for the one financing. And the third part of the bill would be to eliminate the ability for and these out-of-state or cross-borders financings to be used for the SCARP to be used for these financings.
Okay, thanks, Michael. And then with regard to CHESLA and minority teacher recruitment, Josh is going to comment on that.
So basically the goal here is to incentivize minority teacher recruitment by offering an interest rate subsidy on CHESL loans. We believe this is consistent with the State Department of Education priorities. Public Act 1974 sets a goal to annually hire and employ 250 minority teachers and administrators. In terms of funding needs, CHESL would be seeking general obligation bonds to fund the subsidy, as CHESL must maintain loan revenues to pay off its own student loan bonds. On the next slide, basically we have the eligibility requirements. So the teacher must be employed in a Connecticut public school. I would also like to note a key point here, which is that the teacher must be employed in a district with a 35% or higher minority student population. So the goal here is to not only incentivize minority teachers, but to incentivize them to work in specific districts as well. We would also be seeking a five-year commitment for that teacher to stay in Connecticut. There will also potentially be other eligibility criteria as established by CHESLA and the State Department of Education. There's been some thought to incentivizing these minority teachers in particular teaching fields or subjects. If the borrower no longer met the eligibility requirement, the loan rate would revert back to the unsubsidized rate based on the CHESL promissory note. This incentive would be made available to recent Connecticut graduates with existing CHESL in-school loans, and also graduates who refinance their prior student loans with CHESL's Refi CT program. To close, we have run some numbers regarding the impact and cost. A recent report released in October established that the average Connecticut student loan debt upon graduation is about $39,000. We ran some numbers assuming 250 teachers annually with both our in-school program and refinance program. And the determination is that, for example, a 100% subsidy for 5 years would cost the state about $3 million for 250 teachers annually, or a subsidy of about $12,000 per teacher. So we believe this is a low-cost program with potentially significant impacts for the state and its workforce needs. Thank you.
Dan Kurowski. We can't hear you, Dan. Okay. In the meantime, Michael, do you want to just lead off? And maybe Dan's available. Are you there, Dan?
Yeah, sorry about that. For some reason, it wouldn't let me come off mute. I had to dial back in. We will be proposing the creation of a Connecticut New Markets Tax Credit Program and a Connecticut Tax Credit to incentivize $50 million in economic development in Connecticut's low-income communities over the next 2 years. The program would offer a Connecticut state income tax credit equal to 39% of a qualified equity investment. Investors would claim that tax credit over a 7-year period. This is very similar to the federal tax credit program. The only difference is we're proposing an application percentage of the tax credit that is a little bit different, where we'll be utilizing the tax credit that we claimed over the last 5 years, and there will be no tax credits claimed over the first 2 years. This would allow a little more flexibility in the near term for the financial impact to the state. Investments would be made into nonprofits who are located in or servicing low-income communities. And instead of a competitive application process that the federal program has, Chief of CVC would be responsible for administering the program and allocating the full $50 million in tax credit authority. On the next slide. There would be a $5 million limitation on the number of tax credits that could be allocated to a project, and this would allow us to distribute the tax credits across the state. Rather than just one or two projects, we could fund up to 5 projects with this limited resource. That $5 million limitation would create about a $1 million subsidy for a qualified project. On the table, we projected on the slide, you can see our projections for the amount of tax credits we claimed for the 2 allocation rounds. Investors would not claim any tax credits over the first 2 years of the program, and the maximum annual tax credits claimed per year would be $4 million. So the total cost of the tax credits to incentivize $50 million in economic development in Connecticut's own communities would be $19.5 million spread out over 8 years. Sorry. In addition to the proposed legislation to create the Connecticut New Markets Tax Credit Program, staff will be also proposing legislation to allow for the use of bond-funded grants to be invested in a qualified community development entity for purposes of the Connecticut New Markets Tax Credit Program. Current legislation allows for bond-funded grants to be invested in a CDE for purposes of the federal program. This would allow organizations to use grant funds to finance their obligation for the New Markets Tax Credit transaction. The additional proposed legislation would only be necessary if the legislation to create the New Markets Tax Credit Program is passed. Is there any questions on this program?
And are there any questions on any portions of the legislative agenda that have been presented?
This is Daryl. On the cross-border finance, I just wanted to confirm what I think I heard, which was, or is that we could provide financing across borders, but the SCARF wouldn't apply? Or is it that the whole concept of financing across the states or outside the state's borders was removed?
For any cross-border financing, the SCARF would not apply.
Okay, so we would, if the legislation is successful, be able to finance across state lines. Do you have an example of where and why we would do that?
Well, as the system, well, like I said, for the Western Connecticut Health Network, merging with HealthQuest, I mean, you look at, you know, Hartford HealthCare, if they were going to merge with them, a system or a hospital in Massachusetts, you know, that's helpful. To enhance, the, you know, their market share and their financial viability. It's just so you won't have to get two issuers involved for the financing.
And the other piece of it is from sort of an economic and a, you know, healthcare services provision perspective, we also think it makes sense. It's in keeping with, you know, making sure that residents of the state have adequate job opportunities, access to services, because obviously people can cross a state line to get health care, they can cross a state line for employment. So it is still, even though they reside in Connecticut, so it is still ultimately in keeping with this bigger picture role of CHIFA and its finances.
Okay, well, maybe one follow-up, maybe it's two, but I think they're similar enough to be one. So that sounds like we wouldn't just be financing non-Connecticut-based projects. It would there would be a tie to Connecticut, which the second part of it, which may be a continuation of the same question or a separate question, is it for contiguous states only, or would, could it be anywhere in the country?
So it's not for contiguous states only in the, in, there's always a Connecticut nexus.
Okay.
So it's either the contiguous states, perhaps headquartered outside of Connecticut, but otherwise it's if you're headquartered in Connecticut, the other scenario would be if you're headquartered in Connecticut, then, you know, somebody wants to do something in New York. Or somebody wants to do something in New Hampshire or New Jersey. So it doesn't have to be contiguous at that point.
Okay.
If you're headquartered in Connecticut.
Sure.
Michael, is that accurate?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And just also just point of clarification on the SCARF. Obviously, none of our healthcare deals are SCARF backed in general. It's just that there is a somewhat obscure provision in our legislation that already exists. You know, decades ago, a hospital equipment financing program was created that was never used, and it provided for the use of the SCARF. So for whatever reason, that became a hang up and a question the last go around with this. So I just wanted to also close by asking Dan Gingy to just give an overview of the process or the next steps in terms of trying to move this forward.
Thank you, Jeanette. So the General Assembly is set to convene on January 6th. And as part of our preparation for that, we've been holding meetings with state agencies to solicit their feedback on our legislative agenda. These agencies include DECD, the State Department of Education, as well as the Department of Banking. We've been scheduling and meeting with legislative leaders from committees, including the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee, as well as the Education Committee, to also solicit their feedback on our legislative agenda. And on the 20th of this month, we're meeting with staff from OPM and the Governor's Office to review the items on our legislative agenda. Thanks, Jeanette.
Okay. Jeanette, this is an action item, correct? We need a vote on this?
Yes, we would like a vote on it.
And the vote being just to that we're giving the staff authorization to move forward on each of these initiatives, correct?
Correct.
Right. So would someone like to make that motion?
I'll make
the
motion.
This is Lawrence. So moved.
All right, we've got Lawrence moving it and Estella seconding it. Are there any questions on these, the various items that are being proposed under the legislative update? Any questions for any of the presenters?
No, this is Daryl Hill. Not a question, but just to inform, as I think I've done consistently previously, I'll abstain so that the Treasurer's Office retains its independent responsibility in review. But not an indication of lack of support. But.
Understood. Any other questions? All those in favor of accepting the motion on the floor regarding legislative update, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? And one abstention, Daryl.
Yes.
Any other abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries. All right, now we're up to the financings, I believe. Bob, are you going to talk about Doncaster?
Yes, hi, good afternoon. Before I get started, I just want to mention that I believe we have a couple of members of the working group for this financing. I believe we have Keith Robertson, who represents Ziegler, who's the placement agent for the Doncaster transaction. We may also have Betty Anderson, who's a part of management at Doncaster. So if there are any difficult questions.
Bob, yes. This is Mike. It's Mac Welch from Ziegler.
Oh, okay.
And Betty Anderson, the VP of Finance at Doncaster, is on. Perfect. Who just?
Okay. So we have a fairly straightforward financing for Doncaster, which staff is seeking approval for up to $15 million for the Doncaster Series B direct placement with People's United. Proceeds of the direct placement will be used to refinance an outstanding Connecticut Development Authority, or CDA, issue from 2010, which has approximately $9 million outstanding. The CDA issue has a mandatory tender date of December 1st, 2020. Additional proceeds from the proposed financing will be used to fund various capital projects, totaling approximately $3 million on the Doncaster campus. The proposed financing will bear an indicative synthetic fixed rate of 2.35%. We'll have a 25-year amortization and a 10-year mandatory tender. Consensus levels for the CCRC have been negatively impacted as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, in particular, independent living and skilled nursing. Although Doncaster has been very successful in preventing any positive cases of its residents since May of this year. Occupancy in the health center has declined due to the fact that Doncaster has had to stop admissions from outside of its community for several months because they had to set up both an isolation and an observation unit due to the new virus regulations. Additionally, skilled nursing has been impacted by changes in discharge planning after orthopedic surgeries, where in the past patients have been referred to skilled nursing for therapy for a few weeks, those patients now are being discharged directly home. This has been a trend for the past several years, and as a result, Doncaster is working to become a center of excellence for specific diagnosis that will improve their referral number. Assisted living occupancy has been impacted due to the longer time it's taken the CCRC to find residents internally that are willing to move from independent living in addition to a relatively smaller pool of prospects from outside of the community, given the pandemic. However, Doncaster has recently filmed a virtual tour to aid in its sales process and is currently developing a new marketing campaign. The virtual tour has has had positive results thus far, resulting in 5 sales within independent living, with 4 moves scheduled before the end of this year and 1 in early January. Management remains confident sales activity will continue to be positive as a result of the virtual sales tool and new marketing campaign. With respect to COVID-related expenses, management has communicated that through September 30th, there are approximately $200,000 under budget and have held back capital expenditures when appropriate to conserve cash. Doncaster has received monies under the Payroll Protection Program and the Health and Human Services CARE Act. Doncaster is intending to apply for and be granted full forgiveness for the loan received under the Payroll Protection Act. Due to the support of these two programs, Doncaster expects to be able to cover the shortfall in entrance fees that they would normally collect from new LifeCare residents, thus making the overall financial impact of the pandemic to the organization manageable. With that, I will open it up for questions if there are any.
Any questions for Bob on Doncaster? Bob, I have a quick one. This is Peter. The proceeds that are going to be used for capital projects, are those capital projects increasing capacity, building new units, or is it more just for some deferred maintenance on the campus?
I believe it's just going to be more towards more deferred maintenance, but I'll leave that to Betty.
Hi, it's not necessarily deferred maintenance that we haven't been able to do, but we have a couple of significant projects coming up, including approximately $1.2 million to replace all of our pitched roofs. We're a rather large community and the roof is over 20 years old. And the other major portion of that is our apartment renovations. Since we were built in 1984, the design of the apartments themselves is linear, which is not pretty much what people are looking for now and will be in the next 10 years or so. So as we turn the apartments over, we're investing money to get those into a more saleable position. And we've been doing that year over year, but with the amount of inventory that we currently have because of the concerns that have just been shared with you, we would prefer to take our entire inventory and just take care of it all as quickly as we can rather than trying to piecemeal it over the next several years. So those are the major two components that we're looking at.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Bob or anyone on the Doncaster memo? Anyone? All right. Well, staff is seeking approval. Is there a motion to accept the financing memo and recommendation from staff on Doncaster?
This is Mike Angelini. So moved.
Mike has moved it. Is there a second?
This is Alan. I'll second.
Thank you, Alan. We have a second. Are there further questions? Further questions or discussion? The Doncaster recommendation. Right. Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries. Next, Westminster School. Bob?
Yes, thank you. So a slightly more complicated financing, but Westminster is seeking up to $42 million for its Series L and M direct placement with First Republic Bank. The school has approximately $46.7 million of debt outstanding and was last confirmed with an A rating and stable outlook from S&P in January of 2019. Proceeds from the issuance will be used to currently refund the outstanding C, I, and J bonds. Hello? events refund the Series H bonds and finance swap termination fees. Initially, it was the intent to issue a convertible bond for the L3 subseries, but due to tax concerns that had arisen, it was decided that an additional series of bonds would be needed to conceptually make the transaction work. If I could ask Deb to show the second slide, what we can see is for the series L3 bonds that will be issued, they'll be issued on a taxable basis to refund the series H bonds and will carry a yield of 3.25%. Funds will be placed into an escrow until the call date of January 1st, 2024, when the Series H bonds will be paid off in full. If we go to the next slide, the Series M bonds will be executed via a forward purchase contract on July 1st, 2024, and will replace the taxable L3 series of bonds with tax-exempt bonds that will carry a much lower rate of 2.49%. However, in order for all of this to happen, staff will need to conduct a new TEFRA hearing as well as obtain a new governor's approval, which will happen approximately 3 months prior to the call date in 2024. Westminster opened for the fall term, having enrolled 413 students. That's much higher than what was budgeted. They had budgeted 406. Similar to other independent schools, Westminster conducts classes live, simultaneously in person and over a video platform. Additionally, classes are recorded for distance learning students. Currently, the school has 34 out of its 60 international students that are distance learning due to travel and/or COVID-related concerns. These students have been afforded a $5,000 discount per term. The resulting loss of revenue has been offset by the higher opening enrollment. The school is anticipating additional costs related to the COVID-19 pandemic of approximately $1.2 million, which it believes will be manageable. and that's basically what I have for Westminster.
Okay. I know I've got a question, but I'll let others start. Are there questions for Bob on Westminster? Anyone? Okay, Bob, I guess it's back to me. I'll put it right out there. I find the forward contract a little bit confusing. That's just me. But Westminster, I think, is a very strong credit. It's got a great balance sheet. I mean, it's a very strong school. So can you just give me a little bit of understanding? Where did the idea, or what's the motivation? Is it money? Is it a better... Does it save Westminster some money? I mean, where did the motivation come from? What's the rationale for this, the forward contract? Just help me understand the reason behind
sure.
it.
Sure, it's fairly simple. It's largely
simple
being
for
driven
others,
by
I think.
it's largely being driven by the bank. The bank felt more comfortable being able to have this forward purchase contract in place. It was the school's original intention to basically, they would like to have had the bonds just remain outstanding and just do a forward contract, but it was the bank that's really driving the transaction to work the way it currently is by issuing the taxable bonds now, as well as executing the forward contract for the transaction to work. So again, it's really being driven more so by the bank than it is the institution.
Bob, this is Lawrence. When you say forward purchase contract, are you talking about a forward swap? Are they converting from a taxable a taxable rate into a tax exempt and using the forest swap as the as of the July to be able to do that that 4 year because of the fact that there can't be advance refunding prior to.
Yes, sir. You're correct in that there can't be an advance refunding prior to. I believe that you know it's not being issued as a true convertible issue. The way that this was being set up is just so that this is almost as if it were being structured as if it were a Cinderella bond, but it isn't. Everything is occurring simultaneously. However, it's just without having the transaction set up as if it were a true advance or funding, which you know we know can't be done.
Sorry, I was just going to ask if Michael would want to just give the context of tax law and advance refundings. Maybe that will help add some clarity as well.
Well, Lawrence was correct that, you know, you can't do the tax, the advance refunding on a tax exempt basis. I mean, when the tax advance refunding done on a tax exempt basis went away, the banking industry, they came up with this called Cinderella bonds, where you issue taxable bonds to pay off the prior debt. And then at the call date, it automatically converts to a tax exempt rate. We did one, and some other states have done that, but the bond council community, I don't know if they got guidance from the IRS, but they don't like that structure anymore, because you really have to have some type of trigger to cause a reissuance. That's what we're doing here. You know, we're not refunding in 2024. So I think also the bank wants to lock in the financing now. So it's basically, you know, we're doing an advance refunding on a taxable basis, and then come July 1, 2024, it is going to convert to a tax-exempt rate. But it's really not a forward swap. The bank is committing now to buy the bonds in 2024, the Series M bonds, at the 2.49% rate. I don't know why they would commit to that right now, but I think it's a good deal for the school.
So what you're saying, Mike, is that they're basically committing to a tax exempt rate at the 2024 conversion date, you know, exactly. Regardless of whether it's debt vis-a-vis a swap or just their traditional format.
Exactly.
Okay.
But they're committing to the. I'm sorry, this is Daryl Hill. They're converting or committing to the tax exempt rate in 24 now, or is it whatever the tax exempt rate will be in 24?
They're committing that.
They're locking.
Committed to that now.
Yeah. Thank you. This is Alan. Just a quick question. In the in what I would assume is an unlikely event that the TEFRA hearing doesn't go the way we expect, what's the risk to the overall structure?
I think the risk primarily would certainly be that the bond remain outstanding on a taxable basis, and the institution would not be able to, at that time, refund the issue on a tax-exempt basis.
But Bob, isn't that risk de minimis in the fact that, you know, given the point that as long as there are 3 months, you know, to that conversion date, they can go ahead and do that on a tax exempt basis. There's nothing that would prevent them. The real thing here is that because they're trying to lock in and do the refunding and or refinance now in 2020, they just have to just have that taxable period up to that 2024 date. And there isn't any provisions or you know, I think that the issues of reissuance are the risk of reissuance is very low. Correct?
If I understood the original question correctly, with regards to the TEFRA hearing not going through as planned, that's what would make me believe that the institution wouldn't be able to, regardless of whether or not the forward purchase contract is executed, it wouldn't be able to issue the bonds through CHIFA if the TEFRA hearing didn't go as planned and we didn't get the governor's approval as a result.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Any other questions? All right. Is there a motion to, would someone like to make a motion to accept staff's recommendation on the Westminster financing?
This is Lawrence, so moved.
Thank you, Lawrence. Is there a second?
Sue Martin, I'll second it.
Thank you, Sue. Are there any further questions or discussion? Any questions on Westminster? All right. All those in favor of accepting staff's recommendation, please say aye.
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 Aye. Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries. All right. Estella, would you like to give an update on the grant committee's meeting prior to this meeting?
Sure. We met today.
I think you skipped another agenda item, the budget modification.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Cynthia, I apologize for that.
That's okay. Thank you. We've submitted an authorization to get approval for two budget modifications that we need for this fiscal year that were either not a part of the original budget or our modification to what we had put in the budget. And Jeanette was going to speak to the first item, data analysis engagement.
The first item, I think we've made mention of this at different points in time. We are looking at ways that we can assess the impact of CHIFA programs, whether they're grant programs, financing programs, or, CHIFA CDC programs, and to identify what are the relevant metrics for measuring impact, what data is available from our clients, how should that data be accessed. And so it's really just developing a plan and approach for what we're going to collect and kind of how we would collect it. And so we did an RFP for a data analysis consultant, and the preferred vendor is actually the CT Data Collaborative, which is an entity that actually has a long history with CHIFA. It's been around for over a decade, but in its early development, it was actually financed with some CHIFA grant funding. We think they have a great knowledge of what we do, and they're a good fit for what we're trying to achieve. They have strategic data planning services as part of the things that they offer. And their proposed fee is the $17,500.
Okay.
So the second approval needed is for the internal audit arbitrage engagement. As it mentioned here, the initial budget was done and approved in May for $15,000. The subsequent RFP process resulted in the selection of Bond Logistics to perform the activities for us. And at that time, we went in for approval with the board to engage BLX, I believe at $25,000. So what I've done here in this memo is break out the three components or the three phases of that engagement at the new at the levels that are associated with them. And so there's $10,000 for the procedural and policies review, which is the first item, which is a not to exceed amount. And then the calculation review, which we initially had included at about approximately $15,000. And I think because once they got into the procedure and that type of thing, they determined that they wanted to go a little bit further in the weeds and did a few more calculations, resulting in that being at about $19,300. And what was omitted essentially was the final report presentation to our original $25,000 estimate of $5,000. So now we are higher than the budget by $19,300, and we're seeking approval for that modification and the data analysis modification as well. Does anyone have any questions on any of those?
Mark, are you still on the call, Mark?
Yeah, I'm here. And Cynthia Mark, reached out.
No, just yes. As chair of audit finance, did you have any questions or thoughts on this?
No, I'm fine. Cynthia reached out to me in advance just to give me the heads up and walk me through it, and I'm okay.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Are there other questions, comments for Cynthia or Jeanette on the budget modifications? Okay. Denise, a question for you. Do we need separate motions to approve these two budget modifications, or can they be done in one motion?
You can approve both in one, Peter.
One motion?
Yes, one motion is fine.
Thank you. All right, so would someone like to move acceptance of the budget modification as budget modifications as outlined in the memo that was just presented?
This is Mark Verholak. I'll move it.
Mark has moved it. Is there a second?
I'll say
Lauren second. We all did.
All right, we had a couple of seconds there. I think Lauren seconded it. So are there any other questions on these two budget modifications for Cynthia or Jeanette or Mark? Are there any questions, comments? All right. Hearing none, all those in favor of accepting staff's recommendation, please say aye.
Aye.
Are there any no's? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries. And I realize I've been working off the draft agenda, not the final agenda, so that's why I keep skipping things. I apologize to everyone. But I now realize we are up to the committee reports, so Estella, to you.
Thank you. The grant committee met today earlier before the chief of board meeting, and we had two outside presentations. We had two guest speakers. The first one was Carol Dunn, who's the executive director of the Early Childhood Funder Collaborative, and we invited her to talk about the child care sector, which is one of the priority areas for CHIFA. And she gave an overview not only of what her group does, but also what are the challenges in Connecticut and how they are trying to address those challenges by working collaboratively with other funders and the Office of Early Childhood. The second speaker, we had decided and to invite grantees, people who have received major grants from CHIFA, to talk about the outcomes and the impact that the grants have had on the people they serve. So we had Bill Villano and Jill Watson from the Workforce Development Council, who spoke about the training they did, how many participants they had, and how they gave them support. In other words, funding for items such as transportation, which is a key piece of support that most people need in order to get training and work in Connecticut. And also how through CHIFA funds in the second grant that we gave them, they were able to continue doing some training, but they went online, and that became a model for the state that helped the government to continue offering support for workforce training at a very difficult time. when COVID came, part of the challenge for them was that many of the participants in their training who had received credentials and were looking for jobs, those were not available anymore. So they will continue to help them and to also gather data to show the, again, the impact of the grant. So it was very good. And I just want to remind everybody that there's an upcoming conference sponsored by CHIFA on December 9th about the view of Connecticut changing demographics at 9:30 to talk about those changes. And I hope everybody in the board and gets to participate. So thank you, Peter.
Okay, any questions for Stella? I will say just very quickly, for those of you or anyone that wasn't on the call for the grant committee, they were two very interesting presentations. And I just want to express my thanks to Betty and Estella for putting it together. Both speakers were very interesting. It's nice to know how some of the CHIFA grant money is being used. Okay. So thank you, Estella, and thank you, Betty.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Next item, the meeting dates for 2021. Denise, this is not an action item, is it? We don't need to vote on this, do we?
Yes, Peter, you do need to vote on the meeting schedule.
Oh, we do need to vote on it. Okay, well, there's a meeting schedule in everyone's board packet. If someone would like to make a motion, we can act on this.
So moved. This is Mike Angelini.
Mike, thank you. We got a motion. Is there a second?
Second, it's Martin.
Thank you, Susan. Any discussion on the meeting dates? I'll only say that I hope that at some point in 2021 we can meet face to face. But other than that, the dates are fine with me. All those in favor of adopting the meeting schedule, say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Motion passes. Thank you. Please put the meeting dates in your calendar. And I believe our last item of business. Jeanette, do you want to walk us through the action for the CDC board, or would that be Dan?
Dan, are you going to cover that?
Yeah, I can do it. Yeah. Staff would like to present a resolution for the board's approval to appoint Kimberly Kennison and Alan Matamana to serve as members of the CHIFA CDC Board of Directors. Upon approval of the resolution, a special meeting of the CHIFA CDC member will be held to adopt the resolution.
So the CHIFA board approves it and then it's adopted by the CDC board, is that correct?
It's adopted by the member designee.
Oh, the member designee, who is Michael.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. I got a big meeting ahead of me.
Okay. So the resolution is in everyone's board packet. Is there a motion to accept? Anyone like to move that?
This is Lawrence. So moved.
All right. We've got Lawrence to move it and Mike to second it. Is there any discussion, questions? All right, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Alan. And, well, I know Kimberly isn't on the call. Thank you, Alan. Is there any other business to come before the board?
Move adjournment.
We've got a motion to adjourn. Someone's anxious. Anything else?
I'm consistent.
There you go. Is there a second?
I think
there's a second. Well, I'll just end by saying we probably will not be meeting again until the new year. So happy holidays to one and all. And I'll put it out there. I hope 2021 is a little easier to deal with than 2020.
Right. So, Peter, we do have the CDC board meeting. Okay.
Right. Following this. So, all those in favor of adjourning?
Aye.
Aye.
Want to pause?
Aye.
All right. We are.